And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
It turns the brains into guacamole.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara Counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is radical thinking. Each of my guests is talking about some radically different way of looking at things. My first guest claims that living in cities is better for humans as a species than living in paradise like we do here in Ventura County. We examine the benefits of geographic proximity from his latest book, Triumph of the Cities. My second guest is a maverick who burst onto the scene several years ago with his manifesto for challenging conventional wisdom and showcasing the powers of business at its best. We discussed his new business paradigms to transform your company, shake up your industry, and challenge yourself from his book, Practically Radical. My next guest has written the history of one of the country's leading publications of progressive feminine thinking, Cosmopolitan Magazine. We'll discuss the improbable first century of Cosmopolitan to learn the magazine has gone through many iterations before becoming the bastion of feminine empowerment. And if you want to join in the conversation, you can always call us at 639-0008. Dr. James Landers switched careers to become a journalism historian upon receiving his Ph.D. from the University of Wisconsin. After a first career as a newspaper reporter in Alton, Illinois, Danville, Illinois, Des Moines, Iowa, and Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and a stint as a newspaper editor in Milwaukee, Wisconsin as well. Magazine history became his specialty. Magazines reached national readership, eager for information, and he focused in on that. Jim has written or contributed to three other books prior to writing The Improbable First Century of Cosmopolitan Magazine. Jim has taught media history, communications law, news writing, online journalism, and computer-assisted reporting at Colorado State University since 2001. He and his wife enjoy life in Fort Collins, Colorado. They also enjoy biking and hiking. Welcome to the show, Jim. How are you today?
Good morning. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you for being my very special guest here. Now, the first question that got my curiosity is, what sparked you to change careers from a journalist and an editor to becoming a journalism historian? And what is a journalism historian anyway?
Well, what prompted me to switch careers was I had worked for newspapers for quite a while. I had a sense they'd lost their way. They'd been taken over by the marketing people. They'd lost faith in news. And I think that newspapers have an obligation to serve the public. And I just didn't get the sense that we were doing that. And there were many stories that needed to be told about what was going on in communities and neighborhoods. And we were overlooking those, ignoring those, going for features, etc. I had always been fascinated with the history of journalism, knowing that it had been good at times and bad at times, and some of the fascinating personalities who had contributed to American life, and some of those, some of the contributions were negative. So when I switched careers, I really was interested in magazines. I felt newspapers had been written about enough, and I wanted to see what magazines had done at certain periods in American life.
And you focused on one of the more interesting ones, Cosmopolitan, but of all the magazines in the world, you've got Time, you've got Newsweek, The Economist, Life. What made you decide to write a history of Cosmo?
Well, I was one of the oldest graduate students at the University of Wisconsin. And I was looking for a research project, and I was always interested in Spanish-American War. And the United States became a world power, and there had been a lot of debate, intense debate, about whether we should keep the territories we had conquered from Spain, the Philippines, Guam, Puerto Rico, and Cuba. So I wanted to see what magazines had written about in 1898, 1899, and I discovered, to my amazement, that Cosmopolitan was one of the most respected, most serious, and somewhat influential magazines in the era of the Spanish-American War, and that really surprised me. And so I wanted to learn more about the history of the magazine and found out it had changed radically at several times throughout its history, when its readership had stagnated, when it had started to lose advertisers, and when its editors or publishers had sensed that the public mood was changing. And it's odd that it had survived for all that time, because dozens of magazines did not survive. And in fact, from that era when Cosmopolitan started, only National Geographic, Ladies' Home Journal, Vogue remain from that era.
Wow. Only four remaining magazines, three including Cosmopolitan, remain from that area. Now, Jim, you mentioned it, you alluded to it just a moment ago, that most changes in media occur because of changing readership, and ultimately it all boils down to money. The advertisers dry up because they feel that public focus has moved somewhere else. So how many different formats did Cosmopolitan go through, and what were some of the reasons for the changes besides money that you saw in the transition, the transformation?
It started off as a family magazine. It published quality fiction. It had some nonfiction in it, some interesting articles about the Irish question and concerning British rule in Ireland. It published children's stories about children with pets, a talking bird that only a child could hear. It advised housewives on how to iron clothes properly and what was the most efficient method for dusting your drapes. It reached a middle-class readership, and that's what magazines did in those days. A magazine like Cosmopolitan cost $7 or $8 in today's money.
Wow.
And therefore, you wanted to tailor your editorial matter to that middle-class readership. What happened was is that the original publisher of Cosmopolitan magazine, by the way, it was founded in Rochester, New York, not New York City or any other major metropolitan area. It ran out of money after 2 years. The publisher had really just tried too much for prestige and hadn't managed the investors' money very well. One of the original investors, by the way, was Bausch & Lomb, the founders of Bausch & Lomb Optical. So it actually stopped publication for a couple of months, and then a man from Colorado named John Brisbane Walker bought it. He had made money in Denver with an alfalfa farm, had rebuilt the Denver waterfront with his own money.
The Denver waterfront? Hold on, I have to stop you right there, Jim.
There's rivers that come through here.
Okay, go on.
And rivers and some big creeks. And he decided he wanted middle-class America to think about what was going on in the country. There was labor violence, as you know. There was concern about child labor, workplace safety. America debating whether it should take its place in the world and to what extent, at what cost. He was also very much against college education at the time. He felt it was mired in the past. Classical studies should be replaced by science, business, economics, engineering. And some colleges did that, but not enough. So he advocated for those things. He also advocated to clean up urban slums by having wealthy Americans donate 10% of their wealth to build new apartments that were better living for poor people.
So,
and then the buildings would be maintained by the rent paid by the poor people, and they would eat nutritional meals in dining halls at a nominal cost. So everything would be self-sustaining.
All right, so the magazine went from appealing to the middle class to really being much more hard-hitting news and a lot more op-ed. What happened after that particular owner?
It had built a very sizable readership for the era, 400,000 copies every month. But then the publisher got distracted. He'd been fascinated by automobiles, and he invested in an automobile company and let Cosmopolitan kind of drift. So it was losing readers, and William Randolph Hearst was looking for a national publication. He owned quite a few newspapers, and he had political ambitions to be president of the United States, and he thought Cosmopolitan would be his podium to get his political agenda across and to attack his political enemies. William Randolph Hearst never did anything halfway. If you crossed him, he was out to get you, and he would use Cosmopolitan to attack Theodore Roosevelt, and other politicians. They ran a series called The Treason of the Senate, which accused 9 U.S. senators of being traitors for being corrupt, taking money from the railroads and banks. And he built the magazine, William Randolph Hearst, to almost a million circulation. And then he sensed that this expose journalism was losing its appeal, and he switched it literally overnight to all-fiction format. You know, when you change something, you run the risk of alienating your present readers and not attracting new ones.
Sure.
So some magazines try to do it incrementally, and then they wind up offending both classes of people and drop out. Hearst took the chance, and by the Jazz Age, Cosmopolitan was the top mainstream fiction magazine in the United States. Some of the most famous authors in America were published. They were paid excellent money to be published. And circulation passed 1 million. It was fat with ads, as we say in the business, approaching 160, 200 pages a month, of which almost half was advertising. It was making profit of $250,000 to $500,000 a year, and this is back in the 20s.
Wow.
So you can multiply that by a factor of 20. So it's quite profitable.
So most people are listening to the sound of our voice know the more famous editor, yeah. Helen Gurley Brown. How did it get into her possession? And tell us a little bit about Helen Gurley Brown, because you actually have done an interview with her.
Correct. Well, what happened after this peak period of fiction during the Jazz Age is William Randolph Hearst became aged and firm. It was the corporation was taken over by bean counters, and they began taking money away from Cosmopolitan. It began to lose readers. It was on its death's door in the mid-1960s. As you know, television really gutted a lot of national magazines. We lost some famous magazines in the 50s and 60s. Helen Gurley Brown had written Sex and the Single Girl, which was a controversial book and a bestseller about single women and the kind of office romances they had and being free-spirited and living a free lifestyle. She knew that she couldn't sustain her career on that one book, and so she was looking to make a long-term career for herself. She had married David Brown. Her name was Helen Gurley. She had married David Brown, who was a producer in Hollywood who changed fiction into movies, and he had been a former editor of Cosmo back in the early 50s and had passed over for promotion. So they took a prospectus for a new magazine to Hearst Corporation. William Randolph Hearst had died by then. Hearst was not interested in a new magazine because magazines were dying left and right, but they thought they would give her Cosmopolitan and see if she could save it from dying, because they were about ready to pull the plug because it was starting to lose a lot of money. And she did. She changed it into a magazine for, as she described it, youthful women. She really didn't put an age limit on it. She liked women who were had a youthful attitude. And when I interviewed her, she was in her 80s and still working every day in the brand new Hearst Tower. She was in charge of their international editions. And she talked about the resistance she met within the corporation for this new format, which some considered too risque. Sometimes the magazine executives were embarrassed by what was in the magazine. But the circulation went back past 1 million again, 2 million and nearly to 3 million. It went from running 40 or 50 pages of ads a month to running 100 to 120 pages a month. It became the profit center of the Hearst magazine empire. So they weren't going to argue with that. She's very gracious. She's actually very humble. She gave credit to a lot of her associate editors for story ideas and changing the format of the magazine. But she did insist that those were her main ideas, was her vision of what the magazine should be. And I cut the book off in the mid-1980s because that was the 100th anniversary of it. And basically, the magazine is just about what it was. It is now what it was then. It's obviously more explicit than it ever was.
But circulation-wise, ad-wise, it is where it was. We're talking to James Landers, everybody, author of the book, The Improbable First Century of Cosmopolitan Magazine. Jim, if people are interested in learning more about you, learning more about the book, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
Well, just go to Google, do a search, do James Landers, Cosmopolitan Magazine, and you'll get some hits. A variety of online stores have it. Local libraries are buying it, so it's available at various sources.
Ah, that's great. We've been talking to James Landers, author of the book, The Improbable First Century of Cosmopolitan Magazine. If you're interested in journalism, if you're interested in Cosmo Magazine specifically, or if you just want to know a little bit about how a magazine transitioned and morphs over 100 years, this is a great book to pick up and read. Jim, thank you so much for being our guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Well, I appreciate it, Bill.
Thank you very much.